This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A judge looks back on his 18 years on the bench, including overseeing McLean County's child abuse and neglect court.
Termination of parental rights is a very difficult decision. I don't enjoy doing that at all.
Judge Kevin Fitzgerald talks to GLT's Ryan Denham about his career, diversity on the bench, and unprecedented turnover in the 11th Judicial Circuit. Hear how a Normal West soccer trip to Jamaica is preparing players for life, not just the next season. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio to talk about gun violence, the city's new city manager, and new rules governing agenda setting. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Tuesday, June 26th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Bloomington City Council had a busy agenda last night, hiring a new city manager, changing their agenda setting rules, and clarifying when and how to use a tax incentive tool called TIF. GLT's Ryan Denham will cover all of that and more with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner.
Mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after the regular and special council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks for your time again on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Ryan. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, lots to cover from last night's meeting, but I want to start somewhere else with the recent gun violence we've seen in Bloomington Normal. Since your last studio visit here, we've seen five people shot and killed in Bloomington 8 days apart, and a young boy also badly injured in one of those shootings. What do you make of what we've seen here in the last few weeks?
Well, obviously, My first reaction is to send out my sincerest condolences to those who have lost friends and loved ones. It's almost unspeakable. And especially in Bloomington, where we have the lowest crime rate in downstate Illinois, we are so used to not having things like this happen that it does take my breath away. I am very confident, though, that our Bloomington Police Department will get to the bottom of this. We have an outstanding police department. That doesn't mean that some individual officers might not make mistakes, but we have a very, very strong police department. So I'm confident about that. I'm hopeful, and only time will tell, that these are isolated incidences. But I think it does illustrate what I have been saying for many years, and that is we need an at-risk youth program. I specifically support an at-risk youth summer job program. I managed to get some private money for that, even though we had several years ago a budget problem. This is money well spent. Kids from the age of about 14 to 19 work in summers, and they learn what a paycheck is. They learn to be part of society. This is money well spent. There are always multiple panels, as well as exhibitors at the U.S. Conference of Mayors on at-risk youth. And former Mayor Nutter of Philadelphia is one of those who's been one of the national leaders on this. And so I think spending a few pennies up front is well worth it.
What are you hearing from the police department? Are they any closer to an arrest in any of these cases?
Those are the kinds of things that, for obvious reasons, I can't talk about.
Okay. So this program you've mentioned here for at-risk youths for summer jobs, is this something the city's already doing or it did in the past?
We do some of that. I think we need to do much more. Whether or not it's people working at our Parks and Rec department or whether or not it's people who are helping us to cut grass in the summer, whatever it is. One of the things that at the U.S. Conference of Mayors and any mayor who's had experience in this tells you is you must have some additional supervision other than the immediate supervisor so that people can understand how they save money, how they use money, what banking is all about so that they do not become victims of payday lending. I mean, this is really not terribly expensive some information that many of us in the middle class or upper middle class or beyond already know, but a lot of kids who are, and literally, I mean, I'm referring to them as kids, teenagers, don't know, don't understand. And if they get trapped in a situation where they feel like they have nothing to lose, that's where we have serious problems with crime.
The police chief has a new boss, or will have a new boss soon. The council voted last night to hire Tim Gleason of Decatur to become city manager on July 23rd. He'll make $185,000 a year. So why was Tim Gleason the right choice for you?
Well, I think the some of the details of the discussion are part of the executive session that the council went through. I can talk about the process. There were several meetings where we worked with HRGov, the consultant that helped us do a national search for this, and we had about a dozen finalists, and then of that group of about a dozen finalists, we narrowed it down to three, and those are the three that became public, that they answered questions publicly, and I think all of them did an outstanding job. And so Mr. Gleason has certainly had experience in crisis management in Washington, Illinois during the tornado, as well as, of course, in the city of Decatur with economic development. And he's somebody that I believe the majority of city council, and last night was a unanimous vote on the city council, said, yes, with that can-do attitude, that's what we need to move Bloomington forward. We've got to grow the local economy. Growing the local economy is critical for us not to always have to worry about raising taxes or fees in order to cover our inflationary cost increases. Sometimes we are able to avoid those. About half the time since I've been mayor, we have, even though we have lost over 100 full-time positions, we have had no tax or fee increases in spite of the fact that we've had increased costs. We have managed to make that happen. We've also have a reserve fund. We are in, you know, we're not in the best of financial shape, but we're getting there. But if we don't grow the local economy, things could be worse over time. So that's, I think, really critical.
Well, I want to get back to process here on the city manager search. Alderman Diana Howman raised concerns last night about the process for selecting Gleason. She voted for him, but said she didn't like the way that aldermen worked together to get there. She wasn't very specific, so it was kind of hard to tell what she was talking about exactly. Do you have any sense of what she's getting at, and what did you see?
Yes, I do, but in order for me to get into the weeds of executive sessions would not really be appropriate, except for I believe that it is, I think one criticism would be that we could have had a much broader pool for HRGov. I believe her criticism was directed more at HRGov and its process than it was. So I don't think it had anything to do with Mr. Gleason at all. In fact, I believe she said, regardless of whether or not the outcome was the same. So I think let's make that clear. The vote was 9-0 in favor of Mr. Gleason as our next city manager.
And a reporter who covered last night's city council meeting noted that I think all of your votes last night were unanimous, which is the first time you've seen that.
You can like almost, I'm shocked, especially all the things that we were dealing with last night. We were dealing with TIF, we were dealing with agenda setting, we were dealing with the new city manager, we were dealing with spending money on infrastructure, yet all of the votes were unanimous. And so, yes, that's not typical.
Well, one thing that the new city manager, Tim Gleason, will be able to do is put things on the council's agenda. And that agenda-setting ability was discussed last night, and aldermen voted unanimously to enact new rules that will limit your ability as mayor to put items on the council agenda. The plan requires the mayor and aldermen to both submit a form outlining like costs, staff commitments for any proposal to be discussed at a work session first. So what do you think of this change?
Well, there are several things. There are some really good things about it. Let me start out, and that is I believe filling out an agenda setting form so that the public can see, that the clerk can see, staff can see, that's part of the packet, I think is part of openness and transparency. I think that that is a very good idea. Any changes in structure which would limit anyone's power should have been vetted by the public. Most members of the public for the first time saw a newspaper article on Saturday and were puzzled. What is going on? The council may have been discussing this for 8 months, but the public has not been aware of this structural change. It is very different from the original structural change that I would have vetoed 8 months ago. It is also something that was fact-free. Last night was one of the reasons why it was 9-0. It was a fact-free zone. We had no data on what this possible change will accomplish. The proponents initially from this collected nothing, zero information from either the National League of Cities, the national organization, the Illinois Municipal League, or the International City County Management Association that gathers more data on local governments than anybody other than the Census Bureau in the world. No data, not even stories or anecdotes. Not as far as I know, even a phone call to our colleagues in Normal. That is a very bad precedent under any circumstances, but especially when you are trying to change structures. At the end of the day, the structural change, I think, is much ado about either very little or almost nothing. And that is, if you actually read it, there are contradictory parts to this situation. And the other thing is that the mayor can always call, and I may very well have to, for example, on a welcoming cities ordinance, a special session. And the mayor, it's ironic that the mayor can call a special session and write the entire agenda, but part of the ordinance says you need to fill out a form for certain kinds of things. And one of the other things is, you know, when In Bloomington, it's different than in Normal. In Normal, everybody has the same constituency, including the mayor. In Bloomington, nobody has the same constituency. You've got nine wards. Everybody gets a few hundred votes at most from a collection of a few neighborhoods who are on the city council. And the mayor has to run at large and has a very different perspective on things than individual city council members. One concern I have as we move forward, other than the fact that this is not based on any facts, and nobody disputed that last night when I made that point, is that you might very well have specific ward-specific requests that could inundate the committee of the whole meetings. As I mentioned, I was barely mayor 30 days when an alderwoman came to me with over 100 specific requests like fix this curb, fix this alley, do all of these things. And so that is my one concern. If I had my rathers, it would at least have had a second, somebody outside your ward. Now, again, I do not suspect that this particular council will go down that path, but that's not what this is about. When you have structures, you've got to think about a decade or a couple of decades down the line. What are things likely to happen? My guess is this is very unlikely to even last a decade. I think future mayors and councils are going to look back at this and change it again, if nothing else, because there's contradictory language.
So how was the version that the council ended up approving last night different from the version that you had even deeper reservations about 8 months ago that you said you would have vetoed had that been the one that went?
It was five vote. It would have required five signatures to put something on the council. So that means there's going to be backroom dealing, right? You're not going to get, even if you're not violating the Open Meetings Act, you are violating it in principle, if not technically. If five people have decided, yeah, this is what we want, and that's what's required before you discuss something, there are a lot of times things do not have majority support that can build majority support once it becomes public, or it deserves to be voted down. And that's, for example, the welcoming city ordinance. There were five council people who said they didn't even want to talk about it, even though that's not what they said back in December. And so if that's the case, vote it down. But we are going to bring welcoming cities back, even if I've got to have call a special session. It deserves, after we've had a hunger strike, after we've had debates for 16 months on this issue, it deserves at least to have an up or down vote. And if people don't have the guts to vote no, then maybe they need to reexamine their role on the council.
The town of Normal, next door, did pass that welcoming community ordinance. And last week, the town also unveiled its new multifamily recycling ordinance that its council will vote on next month. It'll finally give ISU students who live in all those off-campus apartments the chance to recycle a bit more easily than lugging stuff over to the drop boxes. So Bloomington has a lot of apartments, too. How does multifamily recycling work in Bloomington, and do you see room for improvement?
First of all, the latter part of the question is absolutely there is room for improvement. How does it work in a Swiss cheese kind of half-baked way? If you have 6 units or less, you can use the current system. If you are essentially in the system, you can even have a drop-off site where you can bring stuff to our, as we've now called it, the Citizens Convenience Center. I've got to get used to that.
It's a great name.
Not the city dump, the Citizens Convenience Center. And so at the Citizens Convenience Center, you can do that. But if you are in an apartment building that has 7 or more units, that is not available to you. Illinois Wesleyan University used to collect that, and those bins were usually full. And I think that's really a very unfortunate, and I think that is something that should be one of our top priorities moving forward. If we want to be a sustainable city, recycling should be available to everyone.
Do you think there's an appetite for that kind of change among aldermen, at least a majority of aldermen?
I think that there's an appetite for that amongst more aldermen. Alderwoman Karen Schmidt and I have been talking about trying to have, just like downtown or uptown Normal has, trash cans and recycling bins throughout the downtown and in the Coliseum. And that would be a start. That certainly would be one piece.
Gotcha. Well, I'm going to wrap up with one last topic here. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled last week on online sales taxes, essentially saying that states can require retailers to collect and remit sales taxes on out-of-state purchases. And that decision reversed decades-old decisions that had protected out-of-state vendors from sales tax obligations unless they had like a physical presence in the state. So I spoke to some city officials in Normal and Bloomington. They say they're hopeful that this change could actually lead to more tax revenue coming into Bloomington. What do you think this could ultimately mean for the city of Bloomington and your budget situation that you've referred to just moments ago?
Absolutely. First of all, that is if Springfield passes it. And I have certainly long ago understood that we're in a fend-for-yourself federalism environment. I hope Springfield passes this. If that is the case, then it will certainly affect the sales tax revenues that the city of Bloomington receives, as well as the town of Normal receives. And right now, that is our main primary source of revenue. And one of the reasons why I think it's far better than property taxes is you know that about 30% of that money is paid by people who do not live in Bloomington. Yet they drive on our roads. Yet we have to protect them. Yet they may dial 911. A lot of other issues. So they may commit crimes. So for lots of reasons, I'm very supportive of this, and I'm hopeful that this will help us through our budgetary issues. The one thing that no mayor anywhere can say with any degree of credibility is, I will never raise your taxes and fees. You are immune from inflation. Our costs go up, inflation goes up. I have to pay more for a candy bar and a Big Mac than I did 10 or 20 years ago. And that's ultimately going to have to be the case. What we're trying to do as much as possible is to grow the local economy and try to take advantage of efficiency so we don't have to do that as often.
Mayor Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays following their regular and special council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Koos. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, making an impact one grant at a time, supporting arts and culture, youth engagement, employment, career development, and more. More information about the impact you could have at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas ahead. Here, our high school soccer trip may be preparing players for life in addition to the next season. That interview is ahead during Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. There will soon be a lot of new faces presiding over courtrooms in McLean County and the rest of the 11th Judicial Circuit. Six of 21 judges are retiring or moving into other roles. Unprecedented turnover in such a short amount of time. Chief Judge Kevin Fitzgerald is one of them. The Central Catholic and Illinois State University graduate is retiring after 18 years on the bench. Fitzgerald talks to GLT's Ryan Denham about his career, starting with what it's like to preside over child abuse and neglect court, one of the most difficult assignments a judge can get.
Well, it is very challenging, and it's very difficult sometimes to hear the stories of the children that come in, the families that are broken. The thing I like about it, though, is that I get to make a difference in a child's life just about every day. We are successful most of the time in reuniting families, and if we can fix the problems that existed when the kids came into care and they can go on safely and in a loving environment, that's great. Sometimes it doesn't end up that way, and parental rights are terminated, and most often that results in an adoption of the child or children, and they end up in a much better place than when they started. So the stories are hard and difficult sometimes to deal with, but to see the progress and the turnaround in these kids' life is really very rewarding.
And do you have a specific case that's been in front of you that has kind of stayed with you in terms of making a difference in a child's life?
There have been two cases where I'm sure that the decision that we made to terminate parental rights saved the child's life. It turns out that there were serious mental health issues involved in both cases, and I'm pretty certain that the parent, had the child been returned, they would have taken the child's life, because they indicated afterwards that they would have, and they did some things that suggest that they would have. So that was very rewarding, and that's really a very difficult decision to make. Termination of parental rights is a very difficult decision. I don't enjoy doing that at all, but it just comes with the territory.
And you were instrumental in developing a child welfare mediation program. Is that still in effect? And in what ways has that helped our community, do you think?
There's really two components to it. One is an actual mediation component, where the parties in the case have an issue that they want to resolve. For instance, sometimes it's visitation. The parents want more visitation, and they want to try to mediate how that can happen. Maybe the foster parents can accommodate some visitation. We had one case where the kids were about to be returned home to the parents, and the foster parents wanted to mediate the issue of continued contact. They wanted to set up some kind of schedule where they would be assured of continued contact with the kids, and they did. They were able to do that. The other component of it is called facilitation, and that's a hearing that takes place usually within about a month after the kids. And the parents are there, the attorneys, the social workers, DCFS, if they're involved in the case at that point in time. And we just try to make sure that the parents are getting off to a good start, making sure that the services have already been either scheduled or assessed, that they know what they have to do, that they understand that the system isn't about taking the kids away, it's about getting them back in, but that they've got to make some adjustments usually in their lives. And so, you know, when they come in on they're called the shelter care hearing, immediately after the kids are removed, that has to happen within 48 hours of the kids being taken. People come in, I think, a lot of times just they're like deer in the headlights. The kids have just been removed. They don't understand why. They're angry, and they don't really get what's going on. And so this gives them an opportunity to take a step back, to meet with the caseworker several times, to get assessed for services, and then for them to begin and hopefully, you know, start the train getting the kids back in their care.
Describe for us, if you can, the world of child welfare in this community before that mediation program. Where were the weaknesses in the system that you were trying to kind of amend and get ahead of?
there really wasn't the opportunity at the beginning of a case to kind of assess where the parents were. This actually gets the state's attorney, the public defenders who are representing the parents, the caseworkers. The only one that's really not there is the court, but gets them a chance to really to talk. I can remember that there was some resistance, particularly out of some of the state's attorneys, about the program. And after about two of the facilitations, they said they really just heard the parent talk, and a child was born substance abuse involved in that case, and the state's attorney said she came in looking like this was the devil, you know, the mom was the devil because she had exposed her child to substance in utero. But then she got to hear the mother's story and actually felt some compassion for her, understood a little bit better, and I think that case took a 180-degree different direction than it would have had the state maintained a feeling that this person just needs to have their parental rights terminated from the beginning.
As someone who works with families and is looking out for the best interests of children, I want to ask what you think of what we're seeing at the U.S.-Mexico border in recent weeks, in all of the attention that's being paid to this issue of family separation and the Trump administration's immigration policies. What do you think about when you see those things,
Bert? Well, there's no question that children are traumatized when they're separated from their families and from their parents. We see that on a regular basis, and it's something that we're aware of. One of the reasons that DCFS has a policy of trying to place children with relatives if they can, I think, is to try to minimize that trauma of separation. If they can go to a place they've been before, be in a home of someone they know, a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, it's much less traumatic than just taking them out of their parents' home and placing them with total strangers. Mm-hmm. So I feel for the children in Mexico.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with 11th Judicial Circuit Chief Judge Kevin Fitzgerald, who's retiring next month after 18 years on the bench. In the last several years in McLean County, we've added several specialty courts for defendants with mental illness and or drug problems. What do you think the cumulative effect has been of those specialty courts now that they've been established, been around for a while?
I think it's been dramatic. You can look at the recidivism rates of people who have successfully gone through those programs, and they are dramatically lower than they were before. We used to have real frequent flyers who had mental health issues, and if they can get on their meds and get that regulated, they are much better off. And now we're in the process of trying to divert them even more just out of the system, not even coming into the system at all. Those who come into the system can still go into the mental health program, but we're trying to find services for them outside of the jail, which is what we used to get. And we're also in the process now of establishing a veterans court. The circuit has one that was established and started in January. The numbers aren't great. We don't have a huge population of servicemen. You usually find those in counties where there's a VA hospital, but it's going very well. And if the people can get through that successfully, then the charges can be dismissed and they don't have any lingering consequence. And a lot of it is PTSD or, you know, issues of dealing with violence and being in a war situation. So I'm very hopeful that will continue to grow. But so far, the judge who's in charge of that tells me that everyone currently in the system is doing very well and there haven't been any violations.
Are there any other populations that you think a specialty court might be a nice fit for in 5 years, 7 years?
There are DUI specialty courts. There are substance abuse courts. We've got the drug court, but there's one that focuses just a little bit more on opiates. That we don't have that here. So we could expand them. I would favor maybe expanding the current courts that we have and make them a little more inclusive of people who have those kinds of issues.
So every time I go to the courthouse as a reporter, just as Ryan Denham, I'm very intimidated. I'll be totally honest. It's very imposing. It doesn't feel very accessible and open. You know, it feels a little inaccessible, very highly guarded. That's just how courthouses are. I think that's probably just standard fare. But when I go in there, I always wonder if others feel the same way when they intersect with a courtroom. Do you ever worry about how the public perceives the courts? How much they know about how they really work?
Sure. There have been a lot of studies that kind of suggest exactly what you say, that people come in and, you know, they're usually there because there's something very important going on in their lives, and what's going on is probably the most important thing in their lives at that time, whether it's a criminal case, whether it's a divorce, something with their children. So that even just heightens, I think, the anxiety that people feel. And when they're not in a situation that they're comfortable with, they don't know the judges for the most part. They don't know what they're going to do. They honestly probably don't understand what they're going to face. We've got a very good public defender's office, I know, who is assigned in a lot of cases. They try to explain to people. There's also a lot of self-represented litigants, pro se people, that don't have that benefit, and I'm sure it's a very intimidating environment for them.
Is there anything that can be done on that from a public policy perspective, either roping it into education at a younger age, or even things you can do from where you're sitting on the bench?
We do have some reach out to the community. There's some judges are involved in programs such as 7 Reasons to Leave the Party. They go to high schools and they kind of explain the legal process there and ways to think about making good decisions when you're in certain situations. Public education is a good thing. We probably could do more of that. You know, right now we're going through this process of electronic filing in the court system. And that is in all civil cases currently, but it hits some of our heaviest self-represented litigant courts in the small claims court, which is 75% probably self-represented litigants who have never been to court before, and they've got to now comply with these pretty complicated rules of how to file. So there have been a lot of seminars that have been out there. There's a lot of information on the web. The Illinois Supreme Court has a really good website that people can access. So there's ways to get information, and you don't know how accessible that is to all people, but there's a lot out there.
Well, what do you think of the cameras in the courtroom initiative that's been underway here in Illinois for a couple of years? I think it's moved out of pilot phase into an actual just thing now.
The judges who have had those cases where cameras have been in use really say they don't even notice them after a while. It's just kind of business as usual. And I think it's great for accessibility for the public. We have one courtroom where we can have live cameras, and then it depends on the nature of the case. I think the Zimmerman case has gotten quite a bit of that. I think when it comes to trial, I expect that to be broadcast probably through its entirety. It's been kind of hit and miss on other cases. But I think it's a good thing. I think if people can see what goes on in a courthouse and in courtrooms, I think they'd be less intimidated, for one thing. But it's, you know, they have a right to be there. It's a public environment, and the public should have access to it in one way or another.
So you are planning to retire. July 6th, I believe, is the date.
Right.
And you are not the only one. There are several other colleagues on the bench who've also announced plans to step down this year. Why was now the right time for you?
I was going to be up for retention in 2018, which means I could have gone another 6 years. But I announced my retirement at a time where it would open up the possibility of whoever wanted to apply for it, but an associate judge could apply and not have to resign their position and risk losing their job in order to run. And that's what happened. Bill Yoder was an associate judge, and he applied for it. No one else did. So he's will be elected in November as unopposed. And it's I'm not going to max out a pension, but I've had just other priorities in life. I actually had a little bit of a health scare that turned out to be not a serious thing, but could have been, which kind of put different perspective in my mind. I've got a 1.5-year-old grandchild child who lives in Peoria that we see a lot. And it just was seemed to be the right time for me and for the circuit. I mean, I've been chief judge for almost 4 years. I think it's time for a little bit of a change, a new direction, and I'm just looking forward to the next challenges for me in life.
Well, the bench is still very white and very male in a lot of circuits. Do you think that the Supreme Court and circuits like ours should take opportunities like this to make the ranks of judges more diverse? We have so many openings coming up.
We do. I guess all things being equal, I think diversity is a good thing. I think diversity in gender and race would be great. I think you always want the best person on the bench. I know that we've got some people who have expressed interest in the openings that are coming up that will provide some diversity if they're appointed, and I think there are some excellent candidates out there. And I'm hopeful that we achieve that by selecting the best people for the job who happen to also bring some diversity to the bench.
And we've seen, you know, different announcements come at different times. I don't think I've ever really tallied them up. But how many people are stepping off or retiring or going away in some way?
Well, there are technically 21 judges in the circuit in the five counties. Right now, we only have 20 trial judges because Tom Harris, who's a circuit judge in Logan, is up by appointment to the 4th District. And he's been up there for 5 years. Now he's running for the 4th District seat unopposed. So he'll get that. So that will open up a circuit position in Logan County. Mm. And then Judge Freitag and myself are retiring in July. Two associate judges have announced their intention to resign in or to retire in December. And then there's a judge, an associate judge in Livingston County, who has indicated he's likely to retire next year. So that will be six out of 21, which is the most turnover we've ever had in that short a period of time.
That's 11th Judicial Circuit Chief Judge Kevin Fitzgerald, who's retiring next month after 18 years on the bench. I'm Ryan Denham.
Mark Fellheimer will take over as Chief Judge of the 11th Judicial Circuit when Fitzgerald retires next month. Fellheimer has been on the bench since 2008 and a full circuit judge since 2016. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Mike McCurdy, Illinois' population is slowly declining, according to recent census estimates. An article by the nonpartisan Better Government Association explains how the trend is concerning, but not the crisis some politicians are making it out to be. NPR Illinois' Mary Hansen talked with BGA senior editor Bob Sector. He first discusses some of the common explanations for the state's population loss.
The popular perception is that we are in a free fall, and a lot of partisans will tell you that this is because of our terrible tax climate or our terrible business climate or our terrible pension problem, some variation of all three of those. The reality is it's a lot more complicated than that.
And so why is it that people get it so wrong? Is it intentional?
Part of it's intentional, part of it's laziness, part of it is the hyper-partisan ideological climate that we're in today, where you can see it on a lot of issues, not just on the census, where partisans on both sides grasp for any morsel of data or factoid that they think can bolster whatever argument they're going to try to make. And the real problem with this is that these are complex issues. Why is Illinois population falling? There's no simple answer to that. And we're not going to even start to deal with a solution to this until people stop trying to point fingers and lay blame for something and actually try to take a sophisticated look at a difficult and complicated problem.
And so one of the ways that this article attempts to do that is looking at two examples from nearby Illinois, Minnesota and Kansas. What is it that's happening in Minnesota with population and taxes?
Well, if you just isolate on the Midwest, Minnesota has the fastest growing population in the Midwest over since the last decennial census, the hard count in 2010. They also are the state with the highest taxes in the Midwest. And so if the point you keep on drumming home is that taxes are the root of all evil and that's driving people away, it doesn't fit that narrative. We also looked at Kansas. Until very recently, Kansas was on a tax-cutting tear where the now former governor, Sam Brownback, under him, they slashed and burned their tax rates and created all sorts of credits and exemptions to lower taxes for people because he said that was going to actually supercharge the economy. And it didn't do that at all. And the only thing they accomplished was starving public services and schools, and they've now had to backtrack on that. And the population growth has been stagnant.
There actually have been some interesting population trends going on in Illinois, although maybe not the ones we have been focusing on. What are those?
You almost have to separate Illinois into two parts. The downstate areas, which for us in Chicago constitutes everything from the Wisconsin border down to Cairo, have been slowly shrinking. And that is a trend that is replicated across the Midwest. Less populated rural areas, smaller cities outside of the main metropolitan areas are not doing well. In Chicago, the Chicago area is a little different. In recent decades, Chicago is growing because of a big surge of immigrants, and we also had a large African-American population. The African-American population is leaving Chicago, not totally, but to some extent, and the immigrant growth, especially among Hispanic immigrants, has slowed dramatically. So that's not enough to compensate for what are particularly low birth rates among non-Hispanic whites. And so that is one reason why the population in the Chicago area, which is about two-thirds of the state, it's not shrinking terribly, but it's stagnant.
That's Bob Sector, senior editor at the Better Government Association. He talked with IPR's Mary Hansen on Sound Ideas. Seven people are dead in 2 months, all a result of gun violence. Police are concerned.
We're saddened for the families who have to go through this.
The community is concerned.
We are not going to make it as a community.
And your public radio station is concerned. You're invited to a GLT community conversation, Gun Violence in Bloomington Normal. Question our expert panel and discuss your solutions. Join us at 6 p.m. Wednesday, June 27th at ISU's Bone Student Center Prairie Room. Details at WGLT.org.
The news you need when you want it. That's what you'll find at our website, WGLT.org. The latest local news stories, plus reports from Springfield, Washington, and around the world. You can also subscribe to our podcast and catch up on your favorite GLT features. From GLT's Grow to John Norton's music interviews and everything in between. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. Even if the U.S. isn't competing, the World Cup is proving yet again that soccer is right up there with music and laughter, a common denominator that translates no matter where you're from. The sport was just one of the things that brought 36 Normal West soccer players and their coaches and families to Jamaica this month. GLT's Ryan Denham caught up with Coach Val Walker and team captains Becca Nielsen and Jordan Walker when they got back. Coach Walker says the trip was about preparing his players for life, not just the next season.
We had a day down there where we were just donating items to a primary school and reading some. We brought books and soccer equipment, and we were reading out of some of those donated books to students. Our group was divided into small groups where they worked with different age group kids at this elementary school, and so they were able to interact with these students as well as, and when the reading session was done, we went outside and participated in some soccer clinics.
And Coach, what's your connection to Jamaica? Were you born there or have family there?
I was born in Jamaica. I grew up there. I was a teacher there. I met my wife there. She's a Peace Corps volunteer in 1993 and 97. After living there with her and finishing up a degree, I migrated here in 97 at age 24.
Jordan Walker, you're a forward and a team captain for Normal West. You've been to Jamaica before with your dad here, Vail, where he's from. So what was different about this trip?
I mean, obviously we're there as a team instead of just me with my family, but being there with a group of people that you know that you're going to be bonding with and playing with for the season and have been for the past couple seasons is something that really benefited us, I think, going forward, because now we have that like experience that we can share and always think back to. And also, like, just being there kind of gave us like kind of perspective, I think, just saying like we went to the primary school and high school where he grew up, so I think we all became like more thankful of kind of what he's done as our coach and personally as my dad. Like, we take some things for granted, I think, and seeing like the high school and all that, you just like see how hard like you have to work to kind of pull yourself out of like a situation. Like, I'm not saying it was a bad situation, but just like a different kind of environment, and then coming to the United States and then like having us going back to the trip and like donating a bunch of stuff and having fun with the kids down there. So yeah, I mean, it was a really good experience for all of us, and I think that it's going to help us a lot in the future.
How was the soccer playing against the kids down there? What was that like?
The main difference between American soccer and Jamaican soccer was definitely the physicality. We all were shocked by how fast and physical it is, and that took some adjusting, and it's definitely going to help us like whenever we play against kids that aren't as like physical and fast, and you're not getting grabbed whenever you like try to win a 50-50 ball and you're not getting elbowed. And I think the girls can attest to that too. It took some adjusting, and it was a really good and technical team as well, too. So it was a lot of good experience for us from a soccer perspective as well.
Well, Becca, what about you? What was your kind of favorite part of this experience, this trip to Jamaica?
My favorite part of the trip to Jamaica was probably going to the high school and connecting with all the students. One day they were doing all of our hair, and they were teaching us dances, and I just think that's like, we made a friendship, and even though we're not going to be able to see them, it's still going to last a lifetime. So that was probably the best part. Because we still have like each other's Snapchats and we text all the time, so it's cool.
Becca, I understand you came home without a pair of shoes that you left with. What happened there?
We were at this soccer clinic, and this girl, like, she had size 9, and like we brought a lot of little kid shoes because it was like a primary school, and she's like, I really like soccer. And then so I was like, okay. Also, like, so I gave her my shoes, and also another teammate gave another person a shoe. So I was like, I was really like touched when she was like, I've never had a pair of shoes like these before. I've never had gym shoes. And I was like, well, here you go. And she's like, I don't need to keep them. And they were very polite to us about it. And it just made me want to give them to her more.
Coach Vail Walker, what was that day like for you at that grade school?
And I look in the playground, I see Becca here without her shoes. And I'm like, Becca, where are your shoes? And she just gave them away. And it took everything for me to hold the tears back, because that's exactly what we were trying to do there, is really serve these people selflessly. And so you know, Becca and Jordan and all of our kids got that day. And for me, that's probably one of the most important days we had in Jamaica is serving these kids and learning how to be selfless humans, how to be humans in general. You know, when we were at Stets, you know, the first day I sent them to, that Stets is the high school, I sent them all to classes, and a few of our kids came back and said, oh, they loved us so much. And I'm like, that's what humans are supposed to do. We're supposed to love each other. And so, you know, and that in itself was another memorable moment for me, understanding that, you know, I think in our society, because of our independence, we kind of move away from the social aspect of living. We don't rely on our neighbors anymore for anything. We don't say hi. And, you know, when you go to Jamaica in school and you see these interactions with people with a smile, opening their arms and loving you unconditionally, then we really connect back as humans when we start experiencing those opportunities.
Whenever you travel internationally, you run that risk of seeing only the touristy or resort parts of a country or city. Becca, did you feel like you saw the real Jamaica, not just resort Jamaica?
Yeah, I definitely saw that. I really liked it a lot because not a lot of people that would go there for fun would go to the high schools or give donations to kids that didn't have anything or go and get, like, I felt like our food was really authentic because, like, it was cafeteria, kitchen, and it was, I don't know, I had a whole different perspective on how we traveled. We traveled on these rocky buses that were really fun, and we packed in, like, 40 people to a bus, and for tourists, people like that, they wouldn't be really doing that or been excited, but, like, all of us were having a good time, which was good, even though that we weren't doing all the fun stuff, it was still fun to us, and we were still having a good time.
Both your players here have mentioned the word perspective and their perspective changing as a result of this trip. What did you see from your players and who they were when they got there and who they were when they left?
Yeah, and, you know, in 2006, I did the same trip just with the boys because, you know, 10 years ago, we did not have girls' teams in Jamaica, so the opportunity for our girls to experience this, especially including the soccer aspect, was not available. But I've always wanted to do this again, perhaps many times, because I feel like as a teacher and as a coach, sometimes we go through everyday life and think it's so rough and so hard, and yet because of my background, I realize how blessed they are.
GLT's Ryan Denham talking with Normal West soccer coach Val Walker and team captains Becca Nielsen and Jordan Walker. You're listening to Sound Ideas. You can see photos from the Normal West trip to Jamaica at our website, WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham and Charlie Schlenker. Also, thanks to Mayor Terry Renner for his time. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also, look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR1. We want to know what you think of this program. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 WGLT Normal and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.